Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for June 3rd, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. As promised, I sit down with Bruce Schneier to discuss what's on his mind and ideally prelude to his next book project. As a consequence of the length of this discussion, there is no new hacker word of the week. Also, a word to the wise, those that are concerned about audio quality. Due to vagaries of scheduling and travel, I was only able to catch up with Bruce via a regular phone call. I've done my best as a self-taught audio engineer to brighten up that audio. Hopefully you'll find that the combination of the quality of the content and my modest efforts in making it sound just a little bit better make this a highly listenable interview. I find Bruce's thinking on the subjects of security to be among the most lucid and cogent out there, not just on a technological basis, but as we get into a little bit, especially in the intro and just setting up what Bruce has been doing over these many years, the 5.5 years since I last talked to him, the books that have been really encompassing increasingly broader topics on psychology and sociology, that it really is worth paying attention to what Bruce is thinking about, especially what may be coming up in his next book project. I do again want to emphasize that the catalyst for this discussion was a post on Bruce's own blog, Schneier on Security, a link to which you'll find in the show notes, from early April, that links to about 5 or so essays that I make reference to in the course of the conversation that frame out many of the themes that he's hoping to explore in this book project. And I'm very fortunate that we had an intersection through the day job that he had this opportunity, not actually for me to invite him back onto the program, but for him to invite me to interview him in service of helping him think more about these topics. And I look forward to having him back on when they're a bit more further realized, maybe once the book is published. But also because we do now have this interesting intersection through the Open Technology Institute, who employs me for my full-time regular work during the day, to maybe find some time, not 5.5 years hence, but on a more regular basis to have Bruce back on to talk about some of the other day-to-day, week-to-week issues that are on his mind. Again, as I said, because he is such a clear thinker on this topic. And I think that in absence of clear prescriptive advice, just laying out good frameworks for approaching understandably very difficult issues, and again, not just for technological experts like myself, but for people who every day are increasingly finding the internet and computer-related technologies so much a part of their day-to-day experience. I'm pleased to welcome Bruce Schneier back onto the podcast. Bruce is a well-known security expert whose work is quite broad, encompassing both the low-level technical aspects of information security, such as encryption, but also increasingly the more human-oriented factors, such as psychology and sociology. His most recent book, Liars and Outliers, explored the subject of trust and how it interacts with technology, and he asked me to invite him on to discuss another topic in this vein, about which he has been thinking, with the idea of writing another book, The Intersection of Power and Technology. Welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks.
So you pointed out in the service of exploring this idea for your next book, this post on your blog that enumerates some of the recent essays on this very subject. I have some questions for you that occurred to me while I was reading through these that I thought would be good prompts for some further discussion.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, so on the first one, on internet and power, you talk about the risks of the unorganized, that's kind of one of the key issues I think that we're seeing over and over again, the inability to do the exact sort of shaping in a more proactive frame of the debate that's required to carry things forward, I think, in a constructive fashion. Do you think that's a facet of the internet itself as opposed to other ways and means of coordinating, or something new and inherent to it, or just exposed by this new technology?
Yeah, I'm not sure. There's certainly a lot of things about the internet that are inherently decentralized and allow for more decentralized organization, right? Things from Wikipedia to Twitter hashtags to Syrian dissidents, you know, using it to organize. And you know, some of it has to do with the way the internet works today, the way it happens to work. I think some of it is inherent in any sort of peer-to-peer digital communications and collaboration system. And I think we're really still learning how this shakes out, which is why a lot of this to me is so very interesting. We're right in the middle of it. It's not like you can look back at the printing press and look at the 200 years after and really see how power changed. We're seeing it happen right now, and we don't know what's permanent, what's temporary, what's real, what is just happenstance.
So is something then maybe that is new to this is maybe that there's some meta-awareness, the fact that the internet, that these sorts of systems are a bit more real-time, is that we're seeing it maybe unfolding much more as it happens rather than having to utilize the lens of history to understand it in retrospect?
I mean, there are a couple of things. One is there are a lot of people now on this planet who study ourselves, you know, way different than in the 1400s. So you have scientists, an enormous number of them, who are looking at what's going on in real time. And collaboration and communication is much easier, so those of us who are talking about it can talk to each other and have conferences and write books, you know, things that were harder to do back then. So that makes it easier to study ourselves as things happen. The second thing, which is really different, is technological change is occurring faster than ever. So thinking back to the printing press, that was a singular invention, and you can watch the cascade. The internet is really many different social inventions. It's, right, it's email, and then it's Web 2.0 tools, and then Web 3.0, and they're all very different. And as these things permeate people, right, as they become less technical and more social, they cause changes. But now it's not like, you know, dropping a stone into the water and watching the ripples. It's like dropping stone after stone after stone, and there are lots of ripples all intersecting, and there's just no stopping. So it's much bigger, more complicated, more interesting, and I think harder to tease apart exactly what's causing what.
So a difference in kind, then, you're positing maybe emerging because there's also a difference in degree, that we're getting maybe constructive or destructive interference, to kind of extend your metaphor of the ripples, because of the sheer number of inputs into this complex system.
Right, and the sheer number of people using it, a number of experiments that are happening. So right now, you're talking about power, we see the internet empowering the unpowered. We're seeing that a lot. We're also seeing the internet empowering the powerful. And then this back and forth is kind of an arms race. And arms races are fueled by both money and technology. And back before, your arms race was just, you know, you would get more soldiers, right? You would get more army. Now you can get a better army, a different army. You can change tactics. You can invent new things. So this arms race of power has a lot more dimensions than ever before. I mean, this is the dynamic, I think, that it's really making this a hard issue to understand, to legislate, to figure out what to do, because it's never clear.
You talk about the arms race in your last book. You engage in a couple of interesting discussions of sociological and psychological experiments, like the hawk-dove model, like the prisoner's dilemma, all the variations of that. You even, I think, had a post today as we're recording this on the iterated prisoner's dilemma and some further discussion around that. Do you think this very complexity, this sort of multivariate nature and the speed at which this is all taking place, does that change your assessment of arms races in other contexts where you talk so clearly about the Red Queen problem, that arms races just lead to running as fast as you can to literally stand still?
Yeah, I think those dynamics, which are, in a sense are so general and so simplified, hold true universally, that they are fundamentally human, that evolution itself is a Red Queen race, is an arms race, that throughout history we have tried to vie for power with others at the national level, at the personal level, you know, sort of in different spheres. So I like those thought experiments because they're so universal, and they hold true, and I think they will always hold true as long as we are still human. But exactly how that takes place, I mean, all of the details, I think, change. I mean, Kevin Kelly wrote a book, What Technology Wants, which is really looking at these same evolutionary principles as they apply to technological development, which is not evolution from a biological sense, but it is a continuing improvement in the face of adversity. It's just done in this sphere of human ingenuity, human invention.
What's interesting is that Kevin has also written, like in Out of Control, about sort of emergent complexity and chaos. So I think that that's a really good touchstone for this discussion in terms of some very similar through lines in your thinking. I want to switch to, I think, a more specific example that you get into in another one of the essays on this list, a reification of this sort of power dynamic when you're talking about the new feudalism. And I wanted to ask, how do we avoid the capture that you describe that leads to this sort of online or digital feudalism? I mean, here I'm thinking of the trap of convenience coupled with the unfortunate lack of choice. Jonathan Zittrain, among others, wrote about this, but it doesn't seem like the kinds of theories of action and change frameworks of thought have really sunk in with most regular internet users yet.
Well, so let me tease out the metaphor for listeners who might not have read this originally. I think of, you know, a friend of mine who is very much an Apple person, and she has an iPhone and she has an iMac, and her email comes through her devices and her calendar, and her phone book and her photos are there. And very much, Apple is her feudal lord, and she is Apple's vassal. I have another friend who's very similar with Google. They have a Gmail account, their photos on Picasso, and their all of their Google Docs, and all of their stuff's on Google. You know, very similar. And what it seems is that these sorts of feudal relationships, where providers have all the power and we have to just trust them, is becoming more the norm. And it's becoming a norm for two reasons. One, the rise of cloud computing, right, that our data is often not on our computers, it's somewhere else. And the rise of tethered platforms, like an iPhone, like a Kindle, like a Chromebook, where we don't have control to any real extent over how they work, what we can do on them. And those two things put together means that we are trusting the others more. And you said, why do people do this? Well, it's obvious, because it's actually a pretty good deal for most of us. It's really convenient. It's great. You know, if I lose my iPhone, I get a new one, push a button, and all my data magically reappears on it. I don't have to worry about backups. I don't have to worry about security. Someone else takes care of it. So I think these trends are unstoppable. I don't think the solution is to convince people not to do this, because the power of doing it is so great. And the value of not having to worry about the infrastructure, the details, the tech, is extraordinarily valuable. And individuals and more businesses are doing this. Right? More and more businesses are outsourcing their email to Google, because it makes more sense than running your own mail server. So now we're living in this feudal world, right, where we have little control over the thing, our computing things, either our data or our endpoints, and we have to trust. And the trust is absolute, right? I couldn't even tell you what kind of operating system Facebook uses. I have no idea. I have to trust them explicitly that they will treat my data well, right? They will treat me fairly. And of course, as we know, lots of companies don't. Right? They make mistakes. They treat us badly. You know, in a sense, I am a serf for Facebook, and I am providing data that they use to sell to their advertisers, right, their actual customers. So this metaphor, I don't think goes away. I think we have to figure out, you know, what to do given that's true.
Well, in the essay, you do touch on at least one historical example of what could be done. And I mean, I think you pointed out where the failures in the market, and then also even in the failure in just our norms and that expectation that they'll shift absent some externality. In the classical case that you describe, the state stepped in and it introduced formalisms, it introduced protections, and it took action to regulate that relationship to better balance things. Do you think that's possible here? I worry that we don't even have a clear enough sense for policymakers, for affected constituents to understand the value propositions here, to even start to craft regulatory approaches to this. But I feel that there's something there, that's an interesting suggestion that you hit upon.
So leave the dysfunctional government aside for now, because I think you're right. It'd be very hard to actually do anything in our current political climate. But this is a point that Rebecca MacKinnon makes in her book, Consent of the Networked. What she says, and it's really interesting, that this feudal model was first broken after it was the War of the Roses, right, when we had the Magna Carta. And the problem was that the lords had a lot of rights but no actual responsibilities. And the Magna Carta and other similar documents said, hey, you guys who are ruling us, you also have these responsibilities. You don't just have rights. And she believes that something similar needs to happen in the corporate world, that right now, these Googles, these Facebooks, these Apples, these corporations have lots of rights over us, over our data, over the relationship, but no actual responsibilities, largely because they're often not consumer relationships, right? We're users, not customers. And that some sort of legal regime that limits what these feudal lords can do to us needs to be put in place. Now, how to get from here to there is a huge question. I think you're right. I think it is very fanciful to believe that today, you know, in 2013, the U.S. government, the Congress, and then the president can get together and figure out what needs to be done for the good of society and do it. That's just ridiculous to even suggest. But something like that, I think, is inevitable. Because that's where the power is today. The power is less government power and more corporate power.
I hope you're right, and I think there's a good cause and basis for skepticism here, given that...
skeptical, too.
Sure.
If there's another answer, I'd love to figure out what it is.
Yeah. Well, I think, like you point at Rebecca MacKinnon's work, I think she's doing stuff even after the book, trying to find some accountability mechanisms, trying to explore this question very directly and head on. And I think that as we're able to find other allies and other thinkers to really grapple with this, I think there's cause for optimism, too. You know, I think that it's not that it's a foregone conclusion. I like that you said that it's almost inevitable that something has to emerge. I think that the back pressures are there. It's just how far down the current road of this feudalistic relationship are we going to go, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And what's also interesting, you know, to take this metaphor maybe a little bit too far, right, into Game of Thrones territory, that we are seeing the feudal lords battle each other. I mean, they're battling for control of advertising dollars, of users, of supremacy. And, you know, as we know from the Game of Thrones, when war breaks out in your feudal environment, it's the peasants that get trampled and completely ignored and killed, and, you know, and bad things happen. So, you know, if these large corporate battles get bigger, I would expect that we would more often be part of the collateral damage as services get shut down. I mean, Google Reader got shut down because Google wants to push everybody into Google Plus for reasons to fight against Facebook. But, you know, the people who love that program are collateral damage in that move.
Yeah, and they just dropped, just in the last couple of days, XMPP support. So you talk about open standards, open technologies as being maybe a hedge or an outlet, and they're not even, it seems like paying the lip service to that anymore. I think that's a valid extension in the metaphor. I hope that we can minimize those casualties, but I want to shift on to the next topic that you talk about, since it's, I think, a good segue point. You talk about a cyber war, and I think that you're one of the good, clear voices on this in terms of deflating a lot of the rhetoric and bringing something that we've already touched on, some of your thinking around arms races into this. And my first question is whether you think that there are any sort of even suggestions of antidotes to the pressures involved in a cyber war, like, say, increasing information and transparency. Again, similar to my question about what might need to inform a regulatory approach or a formalistic approach to the feudal state, but just trying to much more directly attack the fear and ignorance that's so operant in these sorts of contexts.
It's now shifting from corporate power to government power. And cyber war is, I think, is largely rhetoric. I mean, it's rhetoric based on fear. There's some serious issues here. You know, primarily, the problem with cyber war as a term is there's no good definition of it. And when things happen, we don't know what's going on. Let me explain it this way. If you think about it, when you're attacked in the real world, there are any number of people you can call on for your defense, right? You're likely to call the police. You could call the military. You can call the Department of Homeland Security. You can call, I don't know, your corporate lawyers or a bunch of products and services you've purchased. But the legal regime in which your defense operates depends on two things, right? Who's attacking you and why? The problem in cyberspace, when you're being attacked, the exact two things you don't know or who's attacking you and why, right? So a lot of people say we're in the middle of cyber war has happened. None of that's true, right? There's no actual war, but there's a democratization of weaponry, right? We're increasingly seeing aspects of cyber war in more broad cyber conflicts, and that's a fundamental problem. It used to be, when you saw a tank driving at you, you knew the military was involved because only militaries had tanks. Right? You can tell who's attacking you by the weaponry. But in cyberspace, everyone uses the same stuff. Everyone uses denial of service. Everyone uses exploits the same vulnerabilities. I mean, Stuxnet, which was a military cyber weapon, looks a whole lot like criminal cyber attacks, which looks a whole lot like cyber activists. And you can't tell. So there is this very strong fear rhetoric born by this inability to differentiate what's going on. And we saw this in Estonia. Estonia is, I think, 2007. It's been called the first cyber war. This was during a period of ethnic tensions with Russia. There was a series of denial of service attacks against Estonian governments and banks and newspapers. They blamed Russia because, you know, that's what you do. You can't tell where these things are coming from. Russia denied it, and the only person ever convicted of these attacks was, I think, a 22-year-old ethnic Russian living in Tallinn. So here's a person launching an attack that's confused for a military attack. That's just weird. That makes this very, very hard to deal with. I mean, to me, a police metaphor is much better, much more realistic, much less scary, but there's a lot of money and power pushing the war metaphor.
Sure, and it seems to be a dark reflection of some of these same sort of category errors and ambiguities that arise in other spaces as well. I much more follow the translation of copyright, intellectual property rights, into this space. And it seems like we have similar sorts of issues that regimes in a more traditional setting get tripped in hard to predict ways. And I am at least encouraged that I have seen some chatter around at least one of the two things that you speak to very clearly, what some call the attribution problem, just knowing who the actors are in this case. Do you think that some of the independent researchers in this space that maybe have come in, like the Colin Andersons at Annenberg, folks in that vein who are doing like really good quantitative empirical research to try to more directly deal with the attribution problem, do you think that's helping, or do you think that's accelerating this down a problematic road?
Well, it's interesting. I think the attribution problem is largely being pushed aside, not pushed aside as bad, is being solved by fiat by some of these corporations. Right? And Google instituted a real names policy for Google Plus. So it said, look, in our walled garden, we're going to have different rules about attribution. Now, of course, any system of attribution can be misused. You can always overlay an anonymous system like Tor on top of an attributed system. But by and large, most people won't do that. So we are seeing systems on the net that require attribution. So your bank. Your bank is going to demand an attribution. That's just the way it goes. It's perfectly reasonable. It's Facebook is somewhere in the middle. You know, Gmail is completely anonymous. So yeah, we have these different systems that are doing different levels of attribution. You know, my worry is that systems that try to force attribution will do more harm than good, because the bad guys can always get around it, and it's the good guys who will be spied upon more. More data will be collected in totalitarian countries. They'll be more persecuted. That anonymity is such a valuable thing that I'd rather we move towards figuring out how to make sure we preserve it than trying to make it as hard as possible.
Well, and I think that's another good segue into another one of the essays that you identify in this early April post, discussing the internet as a surveillance state. And I think this and the next one, which I think just for the sake of time, we may not get to the one on utilizing IT for oppression, but I think there's similar themes there. But in talking about the surveillance state, you talk very clearly and I think cogently, very powerfully about the limits of anonymity because of those few cases where you are required, or even where you're not obligated to attribute and identify yourself, where correlative analysis, like in the case of Broadwell that you talk about, this is the biographer of Petraeus who was revealed not because she took inadequate precautions. Actually, she was fairly savvy about using hotel Wi-Fi to conduct the communiques that went on in this affair, but because then it could be correlated with data about who was actually present in the hotel because of the digitization of those hotel backend systems. And then that makes it even more difficult. So if we're not thinking about this clearly and rightly, as you say, about the preserving the value of anonymity, then I think it's already in the cards. It's already very clear what the end state is.
Well, I mean, there's sort of two ways anonymity is broken. One is the cases like Paula Broadwell, where an investigator manually figured out who she was. And there, I think it's extraordinarily difficult for us to maintain anonymity and privacy. There are just so many ways that you can make a mistake and lose your anonymity. The other is the more automated. Facebook is never going to hire an investigator to figure out the identities of all its users. It's going to build systems that do that automatically. And against those automatic systems, we do better. Against those manual systems, we do very poorly. Now, of course, the problem is, right, you know, things move towards the future, and stuff that is manual today becomes automated tomorrow. So I do think it gets much harder. This recently, I forget where it appeared. It might have been the Atlantic or Wired, and posted an article on how to leak. That if you want to leak a secret to the press, here's how to do it. And it gave instructions for both using the telephone and using the internet. And they were pretty complex. They involved things like buying a phone anonymously and keeping it turned off with the battery removed unless you were using it to make this one call. Right? And then, again, turning it off and removing the battery. Right? Only buying anonymous fare cards. The computer system was equally onerous, right? It involved never using it for anything else. So these mechanisms are extremely difficult against a concerted investigative effort, which is different than an automated marketing-like effort or broad surveillance effort that I'm making, like China would use.
I understand that the threat models are different. I want to focus in on the manual investigation case, because something occurs to me hearing you very clearly distinguish those two, that in the case where there is a human actor and there's I think a lot of settings we expect there to be oversight, is there room then to push back on that? And I know that there's unfortunately a pretty bad trend line when computer technologies get involved in terms of adequate oversight. I mean, we have the warrantless wiretapping from a few years back, and similar questions being raised about, are warrants required to access email? Are they not? We need to update the Stored Communications Act. We need to update the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. But do you think that that's the right right surface to push on there, is that human component? Because there is exactly that. There are law enforcement officers, there are trained investigators who could be normalized to new regulations to say this far but no further. This is reasonable. This line is still, at least at this point in time, maybe not several years down the road, but right now, is still unreasonable.
I think the regulatory regime is the place to push, both constitutionally to restrain governments and through regulatory law to restrain corporations, because you really can't push on the technology. Now, again, we're back to dysfunctional government and unable to get anything done, so how to get from here to there is very difficult. But I really do think that is our only answer. So, you know, one of the problems we have is that anonymous data isn't very anonymous. You know, one solution is to not publish anonymous data, but that would be harmful. Right? Anonymous data is very valuable. Anonymous medical data. I mean, we have all sorts of reasons why we want that data in the hands of researchers. Oh, another solution is to make it illegal to re-identify data. That, look, this is something that we decide you should not do. It doesn't solve it in every case. It doesn't solve the criminals from doing it, but it does solve the major problem we have. So I do think that pushing on the human aspect, on laws and even social norms, is probably our best chance for solving some of these really hard dilemmas. But of course, now we're getting back to the fact that things change so fast that if we solve it today, something would happen and it's not solved for tomorrow. So now how this all interacts with this constant Red Queen race, this constant technological innovation, is something that I don't think we understand at all right now.
I think that's a fair assessment, and I think that in the discussion, I think we've touched upon a lot of the hints of where that might arise from, that it's not going to be any one thing, and that there are some fairly significant challenges to even activating some of the things in the past that we've been able to use, admittedly under a slower rate of progress. I want to respect your time, because I know that you're traveling, you have a fairly full schedule. Is there anything that you want to offer in terms of perhaps opportunities or challenges that have you maybe thinking a bit more optimistically about this question of how technology, specifically how computers and computer networks, interact with power dynamics?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm in the middle of thinking about this. You know, I move from pessimism to optimism, depending on where I am. I mean, technology has created a lot of wonderful things and has solved many, many problems. It also creates problems. And whether on the whole things are better or worse, I think it's pretty obvious that things are better. So a lot of my complaints are around the edges, but on the other hand, technology magnifies power. And that means the powerful will get more powerful. So I think the next 20, 30 years are going to be really interesting, but I'm not convinced that the years after that won't be equally interesting. So we'll have to see.
I'm very eager to see what you come up with more concretely. Very much looking forward to your next book, as much as I've enjoyed the past books of yours that I've read. I'll include links to Bruce's site in the show notes and places where you can find all of his books online. Thank you so much, Bruce, for coming on. This was a very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show, which should be out in the feed in a week, will be a news program as usual. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.